Hello and welcome to Science World.
What we show in our research that when a robot teacher effectively uses gaze, it actually improves learning over a non-effective use of the same kind of behavior.
Facial expressions and body language communicate volumes, which is why a scientist who specializes in human-computer interaction is trying to teach robots how to gaze with meaning. Professor Bill Gay-Mutlu tells us about the work being done to make machines more like man. If all goes according to plan, filmmaker James Cameron will be making a solo submarine descent to the deepest place on Earth. But he won't be the first to do so. Roseanne Scurble has a report about a voyage to the bottom of the ocean made over 50 years ago. In India's poorest and most remote places, doctors are in short supply, so people there still rely on faith healers to help with their medical problems. These stories and more next on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Preparations are underway for filmmaker James Cameron's solo descent in a unique submersible he helped design to the deepest place on Earth, the 11.5-kilometer deep Mariana Trench in the Western Pacific. But Cameron won't be the first human to get there. That feat was accomplished more than 50 years ago by the two-man crew of a U.S. Navy submersible called the Trieste. Roseanne Scurble recalls the Trieste's pioneering dive and talks with that mission's courageous co-pilot.
When Donald Walsh first saw the Trieste, he wasn't impressed.
It had just arrived in San Diego, so it was all disassembled. So it was on this big flat barge, and it looked like an explosion in a boiler factory. I mean, there's pieces, and I couldn't make any sense out of it. I looked down at all these bits, and I was thinking, well, good luck to them.
Walsh was then a Navy lieutenant and aide to the commander of a fleet of submarines. He went with the commander to inspect the Trieste. The idea was to advance ocean science by taking the vessel to the ocean floor at a depth of 11,500 meters, deeper than Mount Everest is high. Walsh says he volunteered for the mission.
What better demonstration of safety of this platform than to go to the deepest place in the ocean and come back and perfectly intact and in working order?
The Trieste is a bathyscaphe, or a free-diving, self-propelled submersible, one of just two in the world in the 1950s. We meet Walsh today at the U.S. Naval Museum in Washington, where the 1950s-era bathyscaphe is on permanent display. It's an impressive craft. The Trieste is over 16 meters long, and its gasoline-filled flotation chambers, deck, rails, and conning tower make it look a bit like a submarine.
Basically, it is an underwater balloon. You've got two parts to it. You've got the balloon here, which is this long cylindrical object, and that's filled with a lighter-than-water substance, which is aviation gasoline. Oil floats on water. So you get buoyancy or lift. And then beneath the balloon, you have a cabin for the fragile humans.
That cabin is a 14-ton spherical steel capsule, only 2 meters in diameter, with a single half-meter-wide circular plastic window for viewing. There's just enough room for two people. On Trieste's historic dive, the co-pilots would be Walsh and Swiss scientist Jacques Piccard, whose father, Auguste Piccard, had designed the craft. In late December 1959, Walsh recalls, he and Piccard headed to Guam to begin a series of test dives.
By the time we got to January of 1960, the month of the deepest dive, we were pretty well familiar with all the workings of this thing, so we had gradually worked our way down, if you will.
On January 23, 1960, the Trieste began its mission in rough seas. Walsh says it descended cautiously through bioluminescent particles and ocean layers of gray, then black, at about 1 meter per second. Things went smoothly until the Trieste was 9.5 kilometers down, when Walsh says they heard a muted bang.
We didn't know at the time what it was. We just knew that we were still alive and everything was functioning well. All our instruments, indicators said that the dive was progressing just fine, so we proceeded.
That bang, it turned out, was a crack in the plexiglass viewing window. Luckily, it didn't leak, and the Trieste arrived intact at the deepest point in the Pacific Ocean's Mariana Trench, a ravine called Challenger Deep. Their descent had taken 4 hours and 48 minutes.
Just before we landed, we saw a flatfish about a foot long. That flatfish would be like a halibut or a sole. That's a bottom-dwelling creature, and it was a fairly high-order marine vertebrates, so that was important to see.
But the landing churned up so much sediment that the 20 minutes the aquanauts spent on the ocean floor was, as Walsh describes it, like swimming in a bowl of milk. The Trieste ascended safely, completing the round-trip mission in just over 8 hours. Walsh understates the accomplishment.
It was just another day at the office, a longer day.
But by the end of that day, the co-pilots were being heralded as heroes who had opened a new era of ocean exploration. Both men remained active in the field for decades. Jacques Picard died in 2008 at the age of 86. Walsh says the Trieste was the blueprint that others would follow.
Almost everything we did on here was a first. Not because we were pioneers or inventors. It was literally, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. We needed something, we had to invent it.
That state-of-the-art technology included underwater lights, cameras, motors, and electrical systems.
Everything on here was new.
Filmmaker and explorer James Cameron will make the journey solo in a unique torpedo-shaped submersible, a one-person craft he helped design with a team of engineers over the past 8 years. Unlike most submersibles, the tiny sub is oriented vertically, and it uses lighter materials like super strong structural foam to improve buoyancy and to withstand the enormous deep sea pressures. Cameron says he hopes to unlock a few more mysteries about life at the ocean bottom.
We know very little about the species that live down there. We know very little about the distribution of the biological communities. We don't know how these animals have adapted to living under this unbelievable pressure that exists down there.
Cameron will film and collect samples on the seafloor for about 6 hours before returning to the surface. When he does, his achievement will owe much to that pioneering dive a half century before by the crew of the Trieste. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. astronomers have created the first complete geologic map of Jupiter's highly volcanic moon, Io. With 425 volcanoes dotting its surface, Io is over 25 times more volcanically active than the Earth. Yet this innermost of Jupiter's larger satellites is only slightly bigger than our own moon. Io's varied surface features include mountains, volcanic domes, plains, and lava lakes. Astronomers at Arizona State University say that their new full-color map shows the location and concentration of the most active hotspots and lava fields on the surface, information that will help scientists better understand the moon's interior processes. This new moon of Io is published on the U.S. Geological Survey website.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
In India's remote and poverty-stricken areas, health resources and qualified doctors can be scarce. Many people still rely on faith-based healers who sometimes promote outlandish theories about how the body works. Kurt Asian looks at one extreme example that has been around for years.
Shyamali Singh is a high school student in West Bengal's Midnapur district who holds a wild belief about dog bites. She says getting bitten by a dog leads to the birth of puppies. The victim gets puppies inside his body, she says, and becomes like a mad dog. So-called puppy pregnancy syndrome has a long history in this locality. Psychiatrist Kumar Kanti Ghosh helped document the phenomenon for an article in the medical journal Lancet in 2003. His interest started when a 9-year-old boy came to his clinic about 10 days after being bitten by a domesticated dog.
There is no history of rabies, but he believes that he has developed pregnancy with a puppy inside his abdomen. And sometimes, and also his parents have said, sometimes that boy is barking like a dog. Sometimes he is crawling on his 4 feet.
Farmer Gopal Singh is one of Singh's patients who was bitten by a dog about 7 years ago. He says he went running to the faith healer, who explained that puppies would be born inside his stomach and he would become like a mad dog and die. Medical doctor Sanjay Samui is frustrated by the tendency of villagers to cling to such beliefs. He says they are uneducated village people. They still hold on to such superstitions. He says he tells everyone it is impossible. In no situation can a puppy be born inside a human body. Doctors say it will probably take years to eradicate medical myths like puppy pregnancy syndrome among illiterate populations. Because so many villagers distrust medical doctors, they say the media and local governments should help promote an accurate understanding of the body and what ails it. Kurt Asian, VOA News, New Delhi.
NASA has deployed a human-like robot where no human-like robot has gone before. Suzanne Presto brings us the latest on the U.S. Space Agency's robot astronaut, Robonaut 2.
So man meets machine aboard the International Space Station as...
Robonaut 2, nicknamed R2, has been on the station since last year, but it has taken some time to check out all of its sensors and systems. Support teams on the ground and astronauts on the ISS have now thoroughly checked R2, and they are pretty excited about this special crew member. There are four Robonauts in existence, but only R2 is in space. We caught up with one of R2's siblings when it visited the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum last year. Engineers designed Robonauts with human interactions in mind, says NASA's Ron Dickler.
You want to be sure that that interaction is comfortable, similar to what it's like when one human bumps into another.
NASA and General Motors work together to create Robonaut. It can perform tasks autonomously or through teleoperations, says Mike Goza, an engineer with the Robonaut team.
That's where you basically put on a helmet. It has two screens in it that correspond to the left and right camera eyes. And so I see what the robot sees.
The Robonaut is able to mimic the engineer's actions by following the sensors on his helmet and gloves.
It becomes basically a huge puppet at that point.
Robonaut's hands are human-like, so they can grip items as human hands do. That is important because the components that need to be serviced in space and the tools to service them were developed with human hands in mind. Goza says Robonauts could reduce the time astronauts spend outside their craft in the dangerous environment of space.
What we'd like to be able to do is, while the astronauts are sleeping, we'll go out, set up all the work sites for them so that when they go out on their spacewalk, they can get more work accomplished in that time frame.
Engineers also envision Robonauts performing routine maintenance inside the spacecraft. Robonaut isn't NASA's first robot in space. Think of the rovers on Mars, says curator of the Human Spaceflight Collection at the Air and Space Museum, Valerie Neal.
Robots have been explorers on the planets all along, but they haven't looked like humans and they haven't acted like humans. And what's exciting about this robot is that it both looks and acts like a person, a rather physically fit person.
Robonauts may one day be ready to explore space. But for now, NASA is still exploring the potentials of this prototype robotic astronaut. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
Scientists say efforts to limit global warming to an internationally recognized safe limit of 2 degrees Celsius probably won't be enough to prevent melting ice sheets from raising worldwide sea levels substantially over the coming millennia. Scientists at Rutgers University say partial melting of mountain glaciers and of the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets alone could increase sea levels by 1 meter by the end of the century. The researchers examined core samples extracted from New Zealand, the U.S. state of Virginia, and the Pacific Ocean atoll of Eniwetok. They focused on a period between 2.7 and 3.2 million years ago because that's the last time carbon dioxide levels were as high as they are today. Global temperatures back then were 2 degrees Celsius higher than they are now.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
A global strategy to develop safe and effective tuberculosis vaccines over the coming decade was unveiled in South Africa this week. Delia Robertson has more from our Johannesburg Bureau.
The new plan establishes international worldwide research targets for the next 10 years, with the goal of having safe and effective vaccines ready for production by 2022. Each year, there are about 9 million new cases of TB and 1.4 million deaths. The disease often occurs in people who have HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, due to their compromised immune systems. And in recent years, strains of TB have emerged that are increasingly multi-drug resistant. David Mametja, who is responsible for TB control and management at the South African Department of Health, told journalists the solution lies in finding a vaccine.
The solution is really in preventing TB. And in that regard, the announced TB vaccine blueprint, we believe, is part of the important solution in terms of minimizing the risk of TB in the country.
Mametja says South Africa is at the epicenter of the global TB pandemic.
So in fact, if you take our incidence rate, which currently stands at almost 1,000 per 100,000 people, so adjusting for our population size, we actually rank first in the world among the 22 countries that account for 80% of the world's TB burden.
Gavin Churchyard, chief executive of the Aurum Institute, an independent public benefit organization that focuses on TB and HIV, says the work going on in South Africa is an important part of the effort to control TB.
South African researchers are playing a leading role internationally in development and evaluation of new TB drugs, diagnostics, and vaccines. Recently, a national plan for HIV vaccine research was launched, and there are plans to launch a national plan for TB vaccines based on the blueprint.
Hassan Mohammed, team leader at the South African TB Vaccine Initiative at the University of Cape Town, says most of the vaccine trials underway are being done in this country.
There are five research institutions around South Africa that are actively involved in clinical trials of new TB vaccines. Of the 12 TB vaccines that are being actively tested at the moment, six of them are being tested in South Africa.
Mohammed says it is also important that local researchers are working together with 9 institutions across the African continent in a collaborative effort to find new vaccines. Delia Robertson, VOA News, Johannesburg.
When you sit down to have a serious talk with someone, it isn't just your words that deliver the information. It is also subtle cues such as the tone of your voice, your posture, and whether you make eye contact with the person you're talking with. If the old proverb, "the eyes are the window of the soul," is true, then there is a lot of powerful communicative potential in our gaze. Professor Bill Gay Mutlu from the University of Wisconsin-Madison knows and appreciates the power of the psychology of body language and how our eyes can deliver messages that are never spoken. Professor Mutlu is not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. He's a computer scientist, and he calls himself a human-computer interaction specialist. His work involves taking various aspects of human behavior and replicating them in robots or even animatronic characters. Professor Mutlu and his colleagues are quite confident that making robots and animated characters look more like humans could prove to be quite beneficial in bridging the gap between man and machine. Joining us for this week's one-on-one segment, Professor Mutlu talks about the work that he and his colleagues are doing to make machines more human-like and how their research could benefit us all. Professor, you said it turns out that gaze tells us all sorts of things about attention, about mental states, about roles in conversation. Can you explain what you mean by that?
When we are communicating with other people, humans communicating, we not only use speech, we use a number of nonverbal cues. And by nonverbal, I mean the tone of my voice, the way that I gesture, the way that I move my head and face and the eyes, my posture, my closeness to you. There are a number of different channels of communication that are beyond speech that also contribute to this communication. So gaze is one of the very potent ones. As I said, turns out it tells us a lot of things. When I'm, for example, talking to a number of people, if my gaze is turned toward one of the people in that group, that most likely communicates that I'm paying particular attention to you, or whatever I'm saying is particularly relevant to you. And research shows that when I end my speech, if my gaze is directed towards one particular person, that person is more likely to take the next turn in speaking in the conversation. So it tells something to other people about, you know, where our attention is turned toward, what we mean when we are sort of directing our questions to people. If we're doing a task together, what I might have in mind as far as my next steps in that task. So there are a number of functions that gaze plays as a communication channel that augments our sort of speech and overall communication.
How do you take that information, even subtle physical information, such as a person's gaze, and convert that into information or data that would allow a robot to mimic?
The way that we do this is that we take a computational approach. What I mean by that is we break that space down into certain variables that we can model. For example, you can think of this as there are different parts of the gaze mechanism that we can model. For example, the direction of my eyes versus the direction of my head, the orientation of my body. So you can think of these as various sub-mechanisms of the gaze system that I can take as variables, and then I can add certain temporal dimensions. You know, how long should I be looking at a particular target? What patterns I should be following when I look at someone? Should I be looking at their face the whole time, or should I be not looking too much at their face? Turns out that people follow these particular patterns. So our goal is to capture these mechanisms, this temporal, spatial patterns in how people direct their attention so that we can get robots, these computational systems, to be able to reproduce these patterns that we observe in people.
So why do this? I mean, what kind of benefits does programming robots to have more human-like aspects have for the people who run them?
You know, the devil is in the details here, because when we look at humans, for example, I love to give the sort of the domain of education as a good example. When you look at people, people use these behaviors very effectively. When they really mean what they're saying, they might open up their eyes and look at you and sort of really try to communicate that they mean what they're saying. If you look at a teacher, for example, when they really want to get a class's attention or a particular student's attention, they use cues very, very effectively. So there's a big space here to understand what effective behavior is and what we can achieve with that. And humans really almost kind of train themselves or develop themselves to be really good at it. If you look at effective teachers, they are the ones that use gaze cues the most effectively. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to develop technology that can use the same effective behavior to achieve similar outcomes. If I'm going to design a robot that's going to perform an educational role, I'd like it to use these effective behaviors. And that's exactly what we show in our research, that when a robot teacher effectively uses gaze, it actually improves learning over a non-effective use of the same kind of behavior.
So as the march toward making robots and machinery more human-like continues, I got a question to ask you, Professor. How far should science go in making machines like robots more human-like? Shouldn't there be some kind of stopping point?
Great question. I personally, this is my personal view, is that there are certain communicative mechanisms that we need to achieve. If we need to interact with robots, communicate with robots in a way that it meets our expectations, it meets our goals that we want to achieve with robots, that's really what the space that we should be in. You know, my goal is not to really mimic humans one-to-one, you know, not a perfect parallel, but to really find the mechanisms and the things that make us communicate effectively and produce them in robots, but not really reproduce a human. Instead, really enable these systems to communicate with us in the way that we communicate with each other.
That was Bill Gay Mutlu, an assistant professor of computer sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in Madison, Wisconsin. That's it for this edition of Science World. We want to thank you so much for tuning in and listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the Internet. Filling in this week for Bob Doty as producer of Science World has been Evan Anechka and Bill Workinger. I am Rick Bantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.